Welcome back to the Religions of the Ancient Mediterranean podcast. My name is Philip Harland. I'm a professor at York University in Toronto. We're continuing on the series Portraits of Jesus in Early Christianity. In the previous episode, we began to introduce the Gospels and provided some important information you need to know before you start to analyze particular portraits of Jesus in the Gospels. And in this episode, we move on to what by most scholars is considered to be the earliest gospel within the New Testament, namely the Gospel of Mark, and we'll be looking at the portrait of Jesus in this ancient biography. We begin by some introductory issues regarding the date of Mark, regarding the authorship of Mark and his identity as a Gentile, most likely writing to a Gentile audience. We then begin to move through the narrative of this ancient biography, looking at the question of how does the plot unfold in a way that portrays Jesus? And we'll see that who is Jesus is the key question of this ancient biography by Mark. In this episode, the first of two episodes on the topic, we'll be looking at the first half of the Gospel of Mark up to a key turning point in the narrative. Towards the end of chapter 8 and the beginning of chapter 9, we have the core turning point in the narrative of Mark's gospel, and the present episode works its way up to that point. The following episode will continue through the second half of Mark. So enjoy this literary and historical look at the Gospel of Mark. Once you're done listening to the episode, feel free to browse around on my website, philipharland.com. where you can read more about the Gospel of Mark and other early Christian literature within the context of the Greco-Roman world. Those of you who would like to read further on this issue of Mark as a narrative may wish to read the book Mark as Story, An Introduction to the Narrative of a Gospel. This is written by David Rhodes, Joanna Dewey, and Donald McKee. I hope you enjoy this episode. Because we only have a few weeks on the Gospels, I've decided to take a narrative approach to them, looking at the Gospels as stories and portraits of Jesus. So today we move on to the first portrait of Jesus that we're going to be looking at, the Gospel of Mark as a portrait of Jesus. So let's get into some of the introductory matters we have to talk about Mark specifically before we try and analyze the storyline and understand the plot and see how the plot unfolds. And see how this whole narrative is structured in a way to portray Jesus and convince you that Jesus should be understood in a particular way. But let's look at the introductory matters first of all. In terms of authorship, date, and genre, and that sort of thing, we need to say a few words. The authorship of Mark is unknown. However, there are early traditions preserved in an author named Papias. Papias writes in the 2nd century. He lives in Asia Minor. We don't have his books preserved. However, little quotes here and there from Papias are preserved in other authors. And quite a few of these quotes have to do with the early traditions about Jesus and how they're orally passed on. And a few of them have to do with the supposed authorship or what Papias thought was true about the authorship of certain gospels. So in the case of Mark's gospel, the fragment from Papias that is preserved is this. Mark, becoming Peter's interpreter, wrote accurately as many things as he remembered. On the other hand, he did not write in order the things either said or done by the Lord. Now, it's possible that there's some truth in this connection between the Gospel of Mark and the figure of Peter. However, there is absolutely no way of confirming or disconfirming this. So historically speaking, we're at a loss. The other difficulty we'll see as we get into Mark that suggests we need to be skeptical about this tradition he heard about is that Mark itself does not come across as a gospel that's originating from the Judean Peter. This gospel does not come across as a very Judean gospel. It comes across as perhaps the most Gentile gospel we have. Even though we don't know who wrote it for sure, even though we don't know the date from that information from Papias, there is internal evidence within Mark and external evidence outside of the Gospel of Mark. There are indications to us that although we don't have clear historical information telling us who he is and when it was written, there are indications of approximations of when it was written and about who the author is, culturally speaking. What's more important in terms of date, and this is dependent on what hypothesis you have in terms of the literary relationship of the Gospels, though. But with our hypothesis of the literary relationship of the Gospels, Mark wrote first, Matthew and Luke wrote later. But when you start to analyze each of these Gospels in their own terms, in terms of internal evidence, and in terms of the first use of those Gospels by another author, most scholars would date Matthew and Luke towards the end of the first century, in the 80s or 90s CE. So Mark is earlier than they are written. Not only that, but there are indications within Mark itself of a date in the late 60s or early 70s CE. Chapter 13 is a key chapter for these suggestions of a date in the late 60s. Because when Mark tells the story about Jesus talking about the temple and relates a teaching of Jesus or a supposed prediction of Jesus that the temple would be destroyed, the way that Mark puts all this material together sounds like the author is writing at the time when the temple either is imminently going to be destroyed, in other words, historically speaking, during the revolt. Remember that there's a revolt in Judea between 66 and 70, and it culminates in the destruction of the temple by the Romans in 70. Our point is, the way in which Mark talks about material about the temple relating to Jesus suggests that he's writing at a time when the temple is either imminently going to be destroyed or that the temple already has been destroyed. In terms of the identity of the author, we don't know his name. Later it's ascribed to Mark, and we have no way of confirming that. However, there are clues within the narrative itself of who this author is, culturally speaking. The author is not familiar with Judean geography. The author has the ability to make mistakes on which passages in the Hebrew Bible he is quoting. The author feels a need to explain what Judean cultural practices are. All of these things together point to, first of all, someone who isn't from Judea, and secondly, potentially, a Gentile himself. Let me point you to some of these things I just quickly sketched over there. Anyone can make a mistake. So even a Judean author who's very familiar with the Hebrew Bible could make a mistake in quoting the Hebrew Bible. Nonetheless, let's look at this one, which seems to be quite blatant. Turn to the very first quotation in the Gospel of Mark. The beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, as it is written in the prophet Isaiah. He makes a mistake that a Judean probably wouldn't make in the very first sentence of his entire gospel. See, I am sending my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way, the voice of one crying out in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his path straight. Where does that come from? Malachi. Together with some of the other evidence we're going to see, this is pointing towards someone who isn't quite as fluent in Judean culture. When the author in chapter 7 is talking about the travel patterns of Jesus, in chapter 7, verse 31, he states something that someone who is from Judea or who traveled around Syria and Judea would not be able to make the mistake of. So chapter 7, verse 31, he has Jesus in a particular place going to another place. Then Jesus returned from the region of Tyre and went by way of Sidon towards the Sea of Galilee. From Tyre towards Sidon and towards the Sea of Galilee. Where are you going, Jesus? You're going the wrong direction. It's wrong, geographically. Jesus is going to end up way up here in Antioch, not at the Sea of Galilee. Chapter 7, verses 2 to 4. Indicate to us at least that the author imagines his audience, the people who are going to hear his gospel, to be primarily Gentiles, because he explains something that no Judean would need explained to them. Now when the Pharisees and some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus, they noticed that some of his disciples were eating with defiled hands, that is, without washing them. Look at this aside that the author of Mark puts here. For the Pharisees and all the Judeans do not eat unless they thoroughly wash their hands, thus observing the tradition of the elders. And they do not eat anything from the market unless they wash it. And there are also many other traditions that they observe, the washing of cups, pots, and kettles. Here we have a little ethnographic description, but it tells you it's one person describing the customs of another people. So that's a further indication of the Gentile audience, at least, that this author's expecting. The final thing that comes together with this, in connection with the identity of the author, is the frequent use of foreign phrases. Now, again, you could interpret this a variety of ways, but together with the other evidence we're pointing to, this suggests a Gentile audience. Mark regularly uses Aramaic when he's telling the story of Jesus. So he'll be telling what Jesus is doing in Greek. He's writing in Greek. The story of Jesus tells all kinds of things about Jesus doing, has a narrative where Jesus is talking to someone, and then throws in an Aramaic phrase to add spice to the story. Wow, a foreign story. This is a story in a far-off land. They speak a different... I don't even understand that word. What is that? This is exciting stuff. That's the effect, perhaps, that's expected. So although we don't have any very solid historical information about who Mark is from someone telling us and when it was written, we can, as scholars, at least get a rough estimate of time, and we can say quite a bit about the identity of the author. In fact, as we're working through the whole narrative, we're getting a sign of who the author is. We get to know who the author is by who he portrays Jesus as. Before we go on, let me remind you of the genre of Mark. Mark, like the other Gospels we're looking at, is ancient biography, and I extensively discussed this last week. An ancient biography is not interested in the psychological development of a character, which is the main focus of modern biography. Ancient biographies are a type of writing that were actually known in antiquity. Lives, they were called. They weren't called biographies, they were called bioi, where we get our word for biography from, bios. These lives are a chronological telling of the public life of a figure, not trying to be comprehensive in dealing with every item in the person's life, but rather being very selective in order to portray the character, the identity of that person, usually stereotyping that character into known patterns of what a philosopher is like, of what a teacher is like, of what a politician is like, of what a soldier is like. And there are stereotypical patterns in the minds of people in antiquity that do all kinds of work on the portrayal of characters when an author sits down to write a life. And that is true of the Gospels and these other biographies. We're going to use narrative analysis to analyze these biographies, including the Gospel of Mark that we're getting into today. And as part of this focus on narrative, we also have to ask questions of who are the characters in the story? What are the function of the characters in the story, including the main character, Jesus? How does the plot help to further the characterization of Jesus? How does the plot unfold in a way that portrays Jesus? The primary question, in a way, overall, for these Gospels is, who is Jesus, is on the minds of the authors. And they have a particular spin on who Jesus is. And the only reason they're telling you the story is they want to promote their spin on who Jesus is. So there's a subjective, moralizing function to ancient biographies, including the Gospels. They aren't interested in giving you objective history, ancient biographies. They are very interested in promoting their understanding of a particular figure and showing you who they think they are. Stereotypes influence how they do that. And so we're getting into what the author Mark does in this process of portraying Jesus. So let's get into that. Let me just outline some of the distinctive features of Mark's gospel, and then we'll get into the three main ones that you need to know in order to understand the portrayal. These are just some items, interesting items to mention to you that are distinctive about Mark. Mark has what scholars would label a lower Christology. I've explained to you that phrase, Christology, before, I think when we were talking about Paul. But scholars developed this notion of Christology to talk about how authors think of Jesus in terms of his identity in relation to God and in relation to humanity. So it's a bit influenced by later Trinitarian ideas, that whole category of Christology, but nonetheless, it's somewhat useful to carefully use it. And if you compared Mark's portrayal of Jesus to Matthew and Luke, you begin to see how low a Christology Mark has, how human a Jesus Mark has compared to other Gospels. Another aspect of Mark that I want to mention at the beginning, in case I forget to reemphasize it, is irony. Literary irony. Literary irony has to do with we as readers having a certain knowledge of things and characters in the story having a certain knowledge of things. And where the reader has a very high knowledge of what's happening and the characters are blundering around not knowing anything, there is irony. And irony creates suspense, where the reader is meant to feel tension and be at the edge of their seat. Why don't these people realize in the story what's happening? I know as a reader. So the narrator of the story, the storyteller, allows us to know as readers, as listeners back then when it was read to people, allows us to know something that the characters in the story do not know. And we're constantly plagued with it. And we're on the edge of our seat about whether anyone's ever going to, in the storyline, is ever going to figure out the truth of things. The whole point of the story and the plot line develops in a way to have key points where the characters in the story do recognize what we as readers know throughout the whole narrative. Let's talk about the central themes of Mark's gospel and then see how the plot works with these themes. First of all, Jesus' identity. Who is Jesus? Is the central theme of the whole gospel of Mark. And the answer that is given is partly what we're dealing with today. But the answer is, Jesus is the Son of God. And another favorite phrase is Son of Man. And we'll soon see there's a key point in the narrative where Son of Man suddenly gets used a whole lot, and it never gets used before the first half of the story. But right from the beginning, Jesus is the Son of God. However, this is where the irony comes in. Only we as readers and a few rare people, including Jesus, know who he is. Right from the beginning, we as readers know. And right from the beginning, no one else knows that very issue and hardly ever knows throughout the narrative until key turning points. So there's some creative portraiture going on in the way the plot line is developed in Mark. Now, as part of this identity, what people do recognize in the storyline, so it's not quite as ironic, is there's issues of the authority of Jesus as part of this issue of identity. Throughout the narrative, there is indications of the portrayal of Jesus as authoritative. So part of his identity, even if you don't know he's the Son of God, which the characters don't know, he's definitely known as an authoritative two things, teacher and authoritative healer. That issue of the identity of Jesus as an authoritative teacher and authoritative healer is ongoing in the story, and it's an issue of debate between different characters in the story. People not liking that appearance of authority, people questioning where his authority comes from. We as readers knowing it's because he's the Son of God and no one else in the story knows that. Tied up in this issue of identity and the issue of Jesus' authority that's linked to that identity of being the Son is secrecy, what scholars have labeled the messianic secret. Throughout the whole Gospel of Mark, until key points in the narrative, no one knows that Jesus is the Messiah. And not only that, but momentary points at which maybe some characters would know it and say one character does say something about who Jesus is and identify him, "You're the Son of God." Jesus says, "Don't tell anyone." Jesus himself keeps his identity secret, and then it gets revealed at key points in the narrative. The secret is what builds the tension for the revelation of who he is. So that's Jesus' identity. Another key theme is the rule of God, or kingdom of God. A new state of affairs where God's control over things is being imposed in a more thorough way. This is a central theme throughout the Gospel of Mark, and it's put in a way that Jesus himself is teaching about the rule of God. Most of the teachings of Jesus in Gospel of Mark are Jesus saying the rule of God is like X, Y, and Z. And the whole narrative begins with him announcing the impending rule of God. And so the mission of Jesus in Mark's gospel is to bring about, in some way, the rule of God, the kingdom of God. So that's another key theme. The third key theme I want to draw attention to, and then you'll see how this relates to the plot, is Jesus at odds with others. There are several different characters in the story that Jesus has consistent trouble with. And these figures that Jesus has consistent trouble with move the plot forward in terms of the portrayal of Jesus, in terms of the continuing secrecy of Jesus' identity until it's revealed at key points. These antagonists make the story unfold in a particular way. There are three main groups of characters in the story that function in this way as opposition to what Jesus is trying to do, namely trying to serve his function as Son sent by God to bring about the rule of God in some way. First of all, non-human forces, demons. Demons are common characters in Mark's narrative. They know who Jesus is. So of the characters in the story, human beings do not know who Jesus is. The demons do. And sometimes Jesus tells them to shut up about it. So demons are ongoing oppositional forces that move the plot forward, and we'll see them repeatedly. Secondly, the authorities. And Mark has a loose sense of authorities, and he groups a variety of people together. Sometimes he'll talk about Pharisees. Sometimes he'll talk about scribes. Sometimes he'll talk about Herodians. These three groups, Pharisees, scribes, Herodians, are somewhat interchangeable for Mark. The point of them is that they oppose Jesus, and that's what really moves things forward to ultimately the execution that the story ends with. The third group that you might think will be, hey, these guys will be behind Jesus, these ones won't be opposing, no. The disciples are another oppositional force, another hindrance to Jesus' activity. And we'll see that Mark's overall portrayal of the disciples is as blundering idiots. They never get anything, and if there's momentary glimpses of maybe finally the disciples are going to get something, they'll foul the whole thing up. And what do they do when he's arrested? They all run off and desert him. The end. We'll see that when some of the other sources who write a life of Jesus get a hold of Mark as a source and tell their own story of Jesus, they seem to have a little bit of a problem with that portrayal of the disciples. So that Matthew rehabilitates the disciples. Now, there may be a function for that that is actually positive. In other words, just because they're portrayed as blundering idiots doesn't mean that the author doesn't think that people should learn something from the disciples. Mark's story of Jesus as the suffering Son of Man is the main portrayal of Jesus here. Suffering is central to the whole portrayal of Jesus in this gospel, and that's the function of the Son, is to come in a way that brings about the rule of God, but also to ultimately suffer, is integral to the identity of Jesus in Mark's portrayal, and then that comes in influence other Gospels who make use of Mark as well. And I want to work our way through some of the key aspects of Mark's Gospel. Chapter 1 of Mark's Gospel begins in a way that draws attention to the very themes I said were central throughout. So right off the bat, the Gospel begins by saying who Jesus is, but the people in the story do not know it. In the very first sentence, the beginning of the message of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So right in the first sentence, you know that this author is portraying Jesus as the Son of God. You have his baptism, and then a voice comes from heaven and confirms that you are my Son, the Beloved, with you I'm well pleased. It doesn't seem to be that Mark is imagining that everyone hears that. It's that Jesus is told that. In the first chapter, look at verses 14 and 15, where the very first thing that Jesus teaches when he teaches something, it's the time is fulfilled and the rule of God has come near. His identity as the Son who is going to suffer is integral to the impending rule of God. Already in the first chapter, look at verses 22 and following. Jesus is teaching, and then the people are astounded by his teaching. We have this authoritative teacher portrayal that people are recognizing, but they don't know why he's authoritative. They don't know who he is, but they recognize the claim to authority or the appearance of authority. They were astounded at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. Just then there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." Demons know who he is, and they're saying who he is. He's going to demonstrate his authoritative healing power, his authority over spirits. Be silent and come out of him. So he heals someone, and in the process, we already have the secrecy element on the table. Jesus is going to keep that secret. If anyone knows it, and it's demons are the only ones that know it in the first half of the story, he's going to tell them to be quiet about it. This idea being central to Mark is confirmed in the exact same chapter, verse 34. And he cured many who were sick with various diseases, so the authoritative healer, and cast out many demons, and he would not permit the demons to speak, because they knew him. We as readers know who Jesus is already, right from the first chapter, but we're already in tension, because Jesus won't let anyone reveal who he is. None of the characters will know this. We're on the edge of our seat because we want them to know it. We know who it is. We're reading through the story. We already know. The narrator has told us. Another healing in chapter 1 that illustrates the authoritative healer and the secrecy issue again. Verses 40 and following, there's a leper who is healed by Jesus. And see what Jesus says afterwards. After sternly warning him, verse 43, he sent him away at once, saying to him, "See that you say nothing to anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer for your cleansing what Moses commanded as a testimony to them." So go to the temple and do a ritual that represents what you're feeling, but do not tell anyone the implications of what I've just done. In other words, my ability to heal you in this way is that because I am the Son of God. So again, it's building that tension. We then get into a section. Mark works in groupings, it seems, where he groups together types of material. Let me just quickly say what I mean in a variety of sections. So chapters 2 to 3 are a series of conflicts with authorities, earthly authorities, institutional authorities. chapters 3 to 4, a collection of teachings of Jesus, both public and private. Then he groups together from chapters 4 to 6 a whole lot of miracles. This is the organizational pattern that Mark is working with in his narrative of the life of Jesus. You then come to the core of the story at that section. Chapters 8 to 9 is basically the turning point. Let's go through these first sections here. First of all, the conflict with authorities, chapters 2 to 3. Jesus in this section has run-ins with scribes, has run-ins with Pharisees. So there's a series of deeds and actions of Jesus that are told about, and then Jesus coming into conflict with authorities over what he has done. And all of this in this section is leading up to the concluding statement of the section. Look at chapter 3, verse 6. The Pharisees went out immediately and conspired with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him. It's a foreshadow of what's going to happen, isn't it? So already by chapter 2, we're told he's going to be killed. These conflicts with authorities are ultimately going to culminate in Jesus being destroyed. Let's move on to the next main section here, chapters 3 to 4, where we have a series of instances where Jesus is teaching things. Mark has brought them all together in a particular way here to further his story of Jesus, the authoritative teacher. What's interesting about how he does this, though, is he distinguishes between Jesus teaching publicly and Jesus teaching only his disciples. Mark portrays Jesus as having a distinction between what he teaches when he's just talking to everyone and what he will teach his own disciples, his own students. Ironically, his own students never get it, even though they have the special teaching. Even though they get the special extra explanation, they never understand throughout this whole narrative. Here in chapter 4, we have Jesus teaching beside the sea, and a very large crowd is gathered together, and he's telling parables. Remember that parables, we briefly mentioned this last week, parables are a style of teaching that are used by teachers in first century Judea generally. What a parable is literally, in Greek, a throwing alongside of, parabole, throwing alongside of. And what you're throwing alongside is, you're throwing alongside of your main point something from everyday life that might help illustrate your main point. Putting an everyday occurrence, an everyday sort of situation that people are familiar with, something they're familiar with, alongside your point, which is not quite as familiar to them, and you're trying to explain what your point is. That's what a parable is. And this parable is about a sower. A lot of the parables of Jesus that are either preserved or presented to us in the Gospels are focused on the sort of thing you would expect in Palestine, farming, and are focused on sort of rural imagery in explaining what Jesus was trying to get across. And here it's about a sower who goes out and sows seed. Some of the seed falls here, some of the seed falls there, some on rocks, some on soil, some on thin soil, some here, some of the birds eat it, etc. So the parable goes forward. Remember, he's talking publicly at that point. He's talking to a large crowd, and he's just talking about a sower who sows seed. He never explains to the public what it all means. This is important to the way Mark portrays Jesus. Look in verse 10 now, what happens after he's publicly taught, and he never explained what his parable means. So he comes and has his own disciples now. When he was alone, those who were around him, along with the 12, so there's a few others with the 12 that are here, asked him about the parables. And he said to them, "To you, disciples, has been given the secret of the rule of God. But for those outside, the public, everything comes in parables, in order that they may indeed look," it's quoting Isaiah, "but not perceive, and may indeed listen, but not understand, so that they may not turn again and be forgiven." So Jesus is portrayed as being secret about his identity in Mark, but he's also portrayed as being secret about his message. He only tells and explains to his disciples, who, in the narrative, do not understand. So it wouldn't have mattered whether he explained it to them. This is important to the whole plot line of Mark's narrative. And then he goes into a detailed description of what the seed is, and it's about the kingdom of God, about who accepts the rule of God and who does not accept the rule of God, etc., right? So that's one of the famous parables of Jesus. Then you have a concluding statement in this section, too, that shows you what Mark has been doing. It also shows you that he was just using anecdotes, little examples to illustrate the character he's trying to portray, just like what we expect from an ancient biography. And he concludes this section by showing you that what he's been doing. "With many such parables, he spoke the word to them as they were able to hear it. He did not speak to them except in parables, but he explained everything in private to his disciples." End of teaching section. We then have from chapter 4 to chapter 6 a whole section that deals with healings. So the previous section mainly portrayed Jesus as an authoritative teacher, and now we're getting more into the side of the authoritative healer. Both of those aspects of authority of Jesus point back, for Mark, to the identity of Jesus and point back to the fact that he's the Son of God who's going to suffer and who is doing so in order to bring about the rule of God. So let's get into these miracles here in chapter 4, verse 35 through to chapter 6. You have the story of Jesus calming a great windstorm, so control over nature. I'm in chapter 4, verse 35 and following. He calms the windstorm. All the disciples are upset about the danger of that. He calms it, says, "Peace, be still." Then the wind ceases. And then in verse 40, he said to them, Jesus says to the disciples, "Why are you afraid? Have you still no faith?" The disciples in Mark's gospel are portrayed as having no faith. Interestingly enough, when Matthew makes use of these passages in Mark, where literally the disciples have no faith, he redacts it. Remember how we talked about redaction, editing, that goes on when a source is used? When Matthew comes across occurrences in Mark where Jesus says that the disciples have no faith, what Matthew does is he makes it little faith. Might not sound much different to you, but it makes a big difference in Matthew's gospel. Because then Matthew defines little faith as if you have the faith of a mustard seed, you can move mountains. Matthew tries to rehabilitate these no faith, misunderstanding disciples that Mark has. And at the end of that, it's back to the identity issue, which is central throughout each of the Gospels, including Mark. Who then is this? The disciples are saying that. They've seen him calm the storm. He says they have no faith because they didn't understand that he would even be able to do that. He's the Son of God. That's why he has that authority, but they don't understand that. Who is this guy? How did he do that? His own disciples say, who is he? Everyone's saying, who is he? Once in a while, someone knows who he is, and Jesus says, be quiet about it. This is where you have another healing. In this case, it's a man with an unclean spirit. In this case, it's in Gentile country. This is somewhat significant. Jesus has gone outside of the Jewish villages, the Judean villages, and he's now in an area that's primarily inhabited by Gentile populations. And he does some healings in those areas. This seems to be important for Mark's gospel, partly because Mark's gospel, as we've seen from some of the evidence I pointed out, is written to Gentiles. So when you're rereading the story when you get home tonight, especially pay attention to incidents that are in Gentile country. And you can imagine Gentile hearers of the gospel, who are hearing the story of the gospel read back in the 60s or 70s CE, would identify with Jesus because he is doing activities in Gentile country. Remember that Judeans might look down upon Gentiles sometimes. And look what the spirits say. Once again, they know who Jesus is. Verse 7, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" The demons all go, there are a whole lot of them, they go into the pigs, and this is the one where they run off a cliff. We're still in the section that's dealing with a series of healings illustrating Jesus as authoritative healer, and that all points back to him being Son of God, but no one really recognizes it except for the demons. This next healing illustrates some of the techniques that Mark uses in telling his story. He uses sandwich techniques sometimes, where he'll be telling one story, and you'll be going, okay, this is a story of such and such, and then suddenly he goes on to another story. Well, tell me the rest of that story. Where'd it go? He comes back to the story after telling a different story, and it builds tension. So he uses that literary technique of sandwiching episodes to build suspense. Mark builds suspense in a variety of ways. He builds suspense through that overall irony I explained about who knows who he is and who doesn't. He builds suspense through smaller things and storytelling techniques like this one. Let's look at it. Chapter 5, verses 21 and following. "When Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered around him, and he was by the sea. Then one of the leaders of the synagogue, named Jairus, came, and when he saw him, fell at his feet." Okay, we have a character, a leader of a Judean synagogue here, coming to Jesus. And he begs Jesus repeatedly, "My little daughter is at the point of death. My daughter is dying." Imagine a real person, a father coming, begging for help, because his daughter is just going to die any moment. "Come and lay your hands on her," he says, "so that she may be made well and live." And a large crowd followed Jesus and pressed in on him. What about going to see the girl? Seems like that's forgotten. "Now there was a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. She had endured much under many physicians and had spent all that she had, and she was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, for she said, "If I but touch his clothes, I will be made well." Immediately her hemorrhage stopped, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. It goes on and on quite a bit about that story. Just a moment ago, we heard that a daughter's about to die. Then look what happens. Verse 35, while he was still speaking, some people came from the leader's house to say, "Your daughter's dead." Why couldn't Jesus do one of his immediately here and there things? Why couldn't he done that to save this poor girl? This is what you as a reader were worried about. The girl's going to die. And then Jesus just takes his time and she does die. Suspense. Why trouble the teacher any further? Jesus overhears that. But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the leader of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." He allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the house of the leader of the synagogue, he saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. Jesus comes in, says, "Get up," and she's raised from the dead, right? This is one of those times where the little spice of Aramaic is thrown in. He took her by the hand and said to her, verse 41, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, get up." And immediately the girl got up and began to walk about. At this, they were overcome with amazement. He strictly ordered them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. So this whole section is focused on portraying Jesus as the authoritative healer, and there's different storytelling techniques that are used in the process. Also in this exemplary miracle section, you have the feeding of the 5,000, which will become very important to us. But before we go to break, let me point out something about that. Chapter 6, verses 30 and following. There's 5,000 people all gathered around listening to Jesus teach. They're all hungry, and he ends up producing bread from a couple loaves. The whole thing ends with, "They were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves, for their hearts were hardened." The disciples still do not understand that Jesus can do these things. And therefore, they still don't understand who he is, because the things he can do points back to who he is. And we're getting close to the middle point right now. That concludes this episode. I hope you'll come again. In the meantime, you can browse my website at philipharlan.com.
I like early Christianity.
The introductory music for this second series in the podcast is my own remix of portions of What You Are from the album Without Zero by Joie. This is copyright 2007 Real World Records, and it's used with permission under a Creative Commons type license.